Hello, and welcome to Barron's Live. Thanks for joining us today. Warren Buffett, considered the greatest investor of his generation and many generations, turned 90 recently, a cause for celebration. At our house, we celebrated by downing Cokes and eating Dairy Queen. Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway has owned a big slug of Coca-Cola stock since 1988, and it owns Dairy Queen outright, along with larger companies such as Geico, Burlington Northern, Precision Castparts, and Fruit of the Loom. I have long wanted to do a Barron's Live segment on Buffett and Berkshire, and I was lucky to find two great Buffettologists to join me today. Barron's Associate Editor Andrew Barry has covered Berkshire for more than 20 years, explaining Buffett's moves and Berkshire's valuation to readers, and even taking Buffett to task when he felt that Buffett could do better by investors. Larry Pitkowski, co-founder and managing partner of Goodhaven Capital Management, has been a Berkshire investor for many years and increased his stake dramatically in March when the stock and the market plummeted. So that reminds me of one of Buffett's most famous lines, to be greedy when others are fearful and fearful when others are greedy. Yet this year, amid a historic market rout, Buffett himself didn't rush to buy. So Larry, welcome to Barron's Live, and I think we'll start the discussion right there. Buffett rode to the rescue of some pretty prominent companies during the financial crisis, but he wasn't a big buyer of stocks when the market sold off in March and April. In fact, he's been a seller of late of airline shares and banks, although he has made some recent purchases, such as Dominion Energy, the pipeline company. What do you make of Warren Buffett's reluctance to snap up stocks as the market was tumbling, or to make what he has called an elephant-sized acquisition this year?
Well, Lauren, it's a very good question. You know, if you recall back to the timeline during the Great Financial Crisis, the timeline between market rout and Federal Reserve and government intervention to provide additional liquidity into the financial markets and fiscal plans to try and stem the market and economic downturn. That period took quite a while, you know, quite many months. And during that period, there were opportunities for rescue finance transactions from companies that were interesting, but really could not access during that period the capital markets. And that was a great opportunity for Berkshire. And if you compare that with the, you know, February, March, April period that we just went through, the timeline between the market downturn, the economic dramatic slowdown, and the dramatic, sizable reaction from the Federal Reserve to provide liquidity into the markets and from the government to provide fiscal plans, that happened very, very, very fast. And I think if that had been a slower process, I think there would have been some rescue finance transactions that Berkshire would have likely done. But instead, those companies were able to access traditional debt and equity financing as the Fed quickly helped the credit markets heal themselves over the short term.
Although a lot of stocks are still down quite a bit from where they were even at the start of the year, and a lot of industries have been kind of demolished, and yet he has not come in, whether as a rescue transaction or a mere acquisition, to do any sort of sizable buying other than Dominion. Did that surprise you?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, you know, Mr. Buffett's, you know, got his view of the outlook, and I think he has been a bit more active, and deputies have been a bit more active lately. They made the Dominion the purchase of the natural gas infrastructure assets from Dominion, which is, you know, kind of all in like a $10 billion deal. They've announced a smaller deal of a typical Berkshire transaction of scripts of a pref with some warrants. They've been involved in the IPO of Snowflake. They bought a basket of the Japanese trading companies all across the board. Mr. Buffett was publicly announced a sizable amount of additional stock in, you know, Bank of America a couple of months ago. So there has been, I think, you know, some noticeable increase in activity as of late, and, you know, we'll have to see.
All right, I will grant you that. He has definitely been doing a little more buying lately. So let's turn to Berkshire's own stock for the moment. It has underperformed the S&P 500 this year. It's down about 6%. The index is up about 9.5%. And I was actually speaking to another Berkshire holder yesterday who told me he's been taking flack from his clients because the stock has been underperforming. They wonder why he continues to own it. So I'm curious, Larry, from your perspective, why has the stock underperformed, and what do you think could change its trajectory?
You know, Lauren, for the only reason that I do anything here at Goodhaven for the portfolio is because I think there's, you know, it's a potential investment that has a manageable amount of downside and plenty of upside. And that's all I was thinking about as we were making sizable Berkshire purchases, you know, kind of February, March, and April. I think what you bring up, though, is a very interesting point because, ironically, Berkshire may be a contrarian investment today, and it's a wonderful thing to have something be a bit contrarian when you've got so much downside protection given, you know, $160 billion of cash on the balance sheet and a long storied history. I think on the performance, I think those numbers are spot on accurate. You know, when we recently stepped backwards and looked over a longer period of time, like from kind of middle of 02 to middle of 20, and it seemed like Berkshire's book value, you know, had outpaced the S&P by a couple of hundred basis points, while the stock had trailed the S&P by a modest amount. Now, that, you know, book value growth over that period of time, that's what management can control, and I think that's the important way to judge them. Lately, you know, book value growth, you know, kind of middle of 15 to middle of 20 has been slightly better than the index, while the stock has lagged materially. So, to me, that spells potential opportunity, and I think Mr. Buffett has responded accordingly by stepping up the buyback program. Why, you know, the recent underperformance of the stock versus, you know, very acceptable growth, you know, an underlying value? I don't know. There's a myriad of potential reasons, but to me, it's spelled in the spring, especially potential opportunity, and so we reacted accordingly.
I guess it's not a fang. That may be one of its problems.
It may very well be.
Right. What do you figure current book value is?
We estimate current book value on the B shares is somewhere around, call it 176, 177 a B, trying to mark the investment portfolio to market and, you know, assuming nothing else really dramatic has happened that would throw that off.
Okay. I'd like to switch to Andrew for a moment. Before I do, I want to tell listeners we will take questions about Berkshire and Buffett at the end of the call, so please type in your questions, and Larry and Andrew will answer as many as we can. So, Andrew, one thing Berkshire has been buying is its own stock, and the company repurchased $5 billion of stock in the second quarter, which was more than all of last year's total. What do you think the outlook is for more buybacks? And how do Berkshire investors feel about Buffett's share repurchase strategy?
I mean, most Berkshire holders want to see, or many want to see, Buffett buy back stock at least the pace that was done in the second quarter of about $5 billion. That works out to about $20 billion a year, or about 4% of the shares outstanding. And given how much cash Buffett is carrying, which is over $140 billion, given the earnings power of the company, which is probably around $25 billion annually, I think investors would like to see Berkshire remain as aggressive or even more so than it was in the second quarter and buy back even more stock. And the stock is now trading for about 1.2 times the September 30th estimated book value, which is actually a pretty cheap level. Historically, it's traded in the last couple of years at about 1.4, 1.5 times book. So it's at the lower end of the range and at a price in which Berkshire and Buffett have said that he thinks the stock is pretty attractive. I mean, he said in the past that 1.2 times book value is a very attractive level.
Okay, Berkshire doesn't pay a dividend despite all the cash that we've mentioned it's got on the balance sheet. And you actually wrote in Barron's recently that the company might pay a 2% dividend yield in the post-Buffett era. I wonder how you came up with that estimate, and do you think the company should pay a dividend now?
Yeah, I actually think Berkshire should pay a dividend. It would broaden the investor base I think that would be attractive to many investors who actually want a dividend. And I think in the post-Buffett era, the company will definitely pay a dividend. So I would say, why not start paying one now? Buffett, however, doesn't like to pay a dividend. He's never paid a dividend, and he doesn't like the idea of it. He'd rather hold the cash for an opportunity. But 2% is actually about a 40% payout of earnings. And so I think that's a reasonable payout ratio compared to other stocks in the S&P 500. It's something that Berkshire could easily afford.
Larry, I have to ask you the same questions as an investor. How do you feel about the current buyback and dividend policies at Berkshire Hathaway?
Lauren, first, I think the buyback thinking has been pretty well articulated to owners. And as an owner, I think that's what you really want. You really want, you know, articulation from management about how to think about it and then consistency in executing it. I find, you know, Andrew's thoughts on the dividend are interesting. I don't feel the same, compelled to say they should be paying a cash dividend now. But, you know, I think Mr. Buffett has said over the years that, retaining earnings, it needs to be tested against, are you seeing, the gradual, increase in stock price over time for the retained earnings? And, over some longer period of time, if that's not the case, I think greater return to, owners would be sensible. But, and I would imagine the odds of that, changing in a, post Buffett, post Munger era, I think are pretty high. But I think for the moment, the policy that they've been executing on is okay with me.
Okay, a satisfied investor for the moment. You mentioned recently when we were talking that you like Berkshire's various engines of growth, and we haven't really talked about some of the company's subsidiaries yet. Some of them have obviously struggled this year as the economy has been hurt, but presumably they'll do better when things start to rebound. So what do you see as Berkshire's greatest growth engines in the years ahead?
Well, Lauren, I think in the very near term, Berkshire's biggest business really is property and casualty insurance. And it's an interesting time to have that exposure for Berkshire. It appears that the insurance market is hardening, meaning pricing and terms and conditions are increasing dramatically. I recently read a comment in the FT from Zurich CEO Mario Greco, who said, commercial insurance is hardening everywhere in the world in practically every line of business, and this is much higher than anything we've seen over the last 15 to 20 years.
What do you
years.
Mean by so, hardening, just for
well,
those who don't
prices
know.
Going up and terms getting tighter, benefiting the underwriter, the insurance companies, after a period over the last bunch of years of somewhat lower prices and somewhat, weakening in terms. So I think insurance is Berkshire's biggest engine, and I think they are well situated to benefit from that. Q3 that we currently just concluded, we'll have plenty of catastrophic claims. There were some hurricanes, there were wildfires. Of course, there were still COVID-19 claims to work through. But I think insurance, property and casualty insurance in the right hands, property and casualty insurance in the wrong hands is never a good thing, should be a great engine over the near term. And of course, Berkshire's other big wholly owned businesses, Burlington Northern and the utility business, look very well positioned. Burlington has some new leadership. And of course, you have the investment portfolio, which one can draw their own conclusions, which is, basically 40%+ in Apple. So those look like very solid engines with plenty of upside.
Okay, good to know. So it is hard to imagine Berkshire Hathaway without Warren Buffett, but we can't escape the fact that he's 90 and his vice chairman, Charlie Munger, is 96. Amazing. There's been a lot of speculation, though, including in Barron's, about who might succeed Buffett when he eventually passes from the scene. Andrew, what's your current thinking on the subject of succession?
Well, Buffett has not said who will succeed him, but I think it's pretty clear that Greg Abel, one of the vice chairmen of Berkshire, is a likely successor as CEO, and I think that Buffett's two investment lieutenants, who've done quite a good job, Todd Combs and Ted Wexler, are likely to run the investment portfolio, which is over $200 billion in equities alone. And his son Howard is in line to become the non-executive chairman. So I think that's how things are going to shake out. I don't think Ajit Jain, who's the other vice chairman, is likely to become a CEO. I think he's given his age and some other issues. I'm doubtful about that. And I think you got a sense about Abel's standing when he was the participated with Buffett at the virtual annual meeting in May. So that's how I think things are going to play out. I'd actually like to see Buffett showcase the next generation more. I think he should have some sort of a virtual investor day or something, introduce Combs and Wexler and also Abel to some degree to Wall Street and the investment community. I think that's something that we've advocated and I think he ought to consider. And I think something that might happen in the next year or two is potentially Buffett might step back from becoming CEO from a CEO and remain chairman and maybe let his successor get some experience while he's still around. I think that's a possibility. We'll have to see what happens, though.
That's an interesting idea. Larry, what do you think as an investor?
Lauren, I think, Andrew's insights into, the four people that are key to the future, I think make perfect sense to me. And I think, Berkshire continues to evolve and, Mr. Buffett has elevated, Greg Abel and Mr. Jain and Ajit Jain. And also you see, a little more, from Mr. Wexler and Mr. Combs on the areas where they are more involved. So I think the evolution is very sensible. And I think Mr. Abel tackled a bunch of questions with Mr. Buffett at the virtual annual meeting last year. And I think that's all, very sensible, well-articulated progress to date, which you would expect to continue.
Okay. Many people have speculated that Berkshire might be broken up after the Buffett era, even though Buffett himself has said that wouldn't be such a great idea. Larry, do you think it's a sensible idea at least? And how do you see the company being structured in post-Buffett times?
I would not expect anything to change, in the post-Buffett era over the short term. I think there are a couple of things that make Berkshire very unique in keeping the structure together. I think you have an insurance business that generates, in the past, an enormous amount of float, which is profitable and which can be used to leverage the investment portfolio. And you have an obvious home for large private companies where they can expect to be able to run their business forever and ever and ever. And I think all of those attributes of what makes the different spokes of the wheel work well together seem like, to me, very sensible things to keep intact. But the wonderful thing about Berkshire over the years is that, of course, Mr. Buffett is a learning machine. And, of course, the organization has been a learning machine. They have evolved as they've gotten bigger. The people have evolved. The areas where they have focused, have gotten involved, all with the same, pointing to the same North Star of trying to compound money while taking very, modest amounts of actual risk. And I think that'll continue, but I would not expect any kind of drastic, structural change, nor would it strike me as it would be needed, anytime soon.
All right, I've got a couple more questions, and then we're going to go to listener questions as they are pouring in. So I want to go back to Buffett's holding in.
Yes. I might say that, I think on the issue of the breakup, I actually think that there may be activists that may surface soon after Buffett leaves the scene. And I think Bill Ackman was in the stock, and he's made some comments about how some of Berkshire's businesses don't have the same returns as some leading peer companies. So I think that while you may debate the merits of it, I think that with the stock trading appreciably below what I think is some of the parts valuation is on Berkshire, that you could see pressure fairly soon after Buffett leaves the scene.
Good. I like a debate. Do you see any activist who would be willing to take on the situation while Buffett is still running the show?
No. I mean, I think no one wants to take on Buffett now. That's why I think potential activists are laying low. Ackman got involved in the stock, then he sold out of it. But you basically, he is so sacrosanct and he's so well regarded that no one would basically take on Birch now. But I think I think Buffett's making a bit of a mistake in not focusing as much on the share price as I would like, as I think many investors would like to see, because a strong share price is basically one of the best defenses against activism and calls for a breakup. And if the stock price were stronger and trading at a bigger premium to book value and to intrinsic value, I think it would neutralize any potential activist action. So I think Buffett really should pay more attention to the stock price, even though he professes not to care that much about it in the short term.
That's an interesting observation. I want to go back to his holding in Apple, which has been hugely successful. And I wonder, Larry, do you fault him for passing on the rest of the FANG stocks at all?
Well, first of all, I don't fault Mr. Buffett for anything. That doesn't seem like a great idea. But
well, your partner there, Andrew, does.
Right. I think Mr. Buffett has faulted himself for passing on Google when, you know, he tells the story of when the Google founders came to visit him early on, and they, you know, and he was well aware of how important the business was to Geico, which used the paid search early on for digital advertising, and he faulted himself for not having done something about it when the company became publicly held. So, you know, he's been out there publicly discussing that. Beyond that, I don't have any real criticisms. And I think the Apple investment is important in a couple of different ways. First of all, it shows the evolution of, you know, Berkshire and Mr. Buffett continuing to, you know, look for opportunities in new areas. And I think his analysis of what made Apple attractive as an ecosystem and not getting focused on, you know, some of the things like, oh, what are handset sales next quarter, has proven to be, you know, given the trajectory of the business, has proven to be right. So, you know, I don't think it's, I think he's been self-critical where it's, realistically, and I don't have any criticisms beyond that.
All right, I have one final question for each of you. If you could each ask Warren Buffett one question, what would it be? We'll start with Andrew.
What do you think intrinsic value is right now, Berkshire Hathaway?
All right, that certainly is a good one. And what would your question be, Larry?
Well, I don't know. I'd ask him, how do you get to be 90 years old and eat all the wrong foods? You know, I'm thrilled to have a kale salad for lunch every day, but, you know, a Big Mac, fries, and a Coke would really hit the spot every so often. That was going to be my question, but, you know.
I have to tell you, one Coke and one Dairy Queen was enough for me for several months. So it's what we sacrifice for work. So let's go to some listener questions. And not surprisingly, one of them is right along the lines of what Andrew has just asked, but the question goes to Larry. What do you think intrinsic value is at Berkshire Hathaway?
You know, Lauren, it's a good question. If you go to the 2018 annual report, you know, Mr. Buffett had said, look, here's how I think about intrinsic value. And I think he called it that we have five groves of major importance. And he said we have our wholly owned subsidiaries, we have the equity portfolio, we have minority, companies that we have a minority equity earnings piece of, we have bonds, T-bills, cash, and then we have some deferred taxes. And, you know, add your own multiple for the subsidiaries, the equities are what they are. And I think if you do that, and, you know, if that's his and Mr. Munger's calculation or methodology, well, I think that sounds quite sensible. I think it's not hard to get a number that's materially above the current stock price. You know, reasonable people will quibble about, you know, which what's the earnings stream of the subsidiaries. But, you know, these are interesting businesses. Some of them are somewhat cyclical. Some of them are in the midst of a bit of a downturn. But I think if you do that calculation, I think you we get a number that's materially above the current stock price and growing over time. And I think that seems to be a very sensible methodology versus many years ago, you know, he used a different, somewhat different methodology, though somewhat similar of, investments per share and operating earnings. And of course, you know, Andrew's the shortcut on book value, you know, we've also considered for many years. And that also makes perfectly good sense because that's how he was benchmarking the repurchase for a while until they shifted it a bit.
Andrew, do you have any calculations on intrinsic value?
Yeah.
Have you done
any
of the math?
I'd say it's probably around $375,000 to $400,000 per A share, which is about a 1.5 times book value. That's what I would guess it probably is right now. You know, the Apple stake alone is over $100 billion. It's $140+ billion of cash. It's not simple to make the calculation, but that's my best guess.
Okay. Well, as you both say, the stock, based on that basis, looks quite undervalued.
Yeah, I mean, the stock is now around $320,000 on the A shares.
All right. Here's an interesting question. Does Berkshire Hathaway stock go up or down on the first day that Warren Buffett is no longer CEO? Who wants to tackle that one?
I'll give Andrew that one.
Buffett has actually said that he believes the stock will be up on the day after he dies. He's actually said that publicly at one of the annual meeting questions. And so I think he anticipates that Wall Street will begin to expect the breakup of the company and will look at the sum of the parts value and view his passing as the end to an impediment to that. So I actually think, while many people think it'll be down because this incomparable investor will be leaving the scene, I actually think it could be up as people anticipate a breakup and perhaps even better operational performance under new management.
Well, hopefully we won't have to find that out for a while.
Yeah.
Here's another question. I was surprised, and I'll give this one to Larry. A listener writes, I was surprised to see Berkshire invest in the IPO of Snowflake, and that happened just this summer. What are your thoughts around that?
My thoughts are that I think I'm quite happy to see Berkshire's deputies invest in areas that they find interesting and compelling with the same North Star to value and margin of safety, especially if they are in industries and areas that have not been traditional Berkshire, you know, areas of great focus, because I think it shows the evolution of the company from a capital allocation and a managerial standpoint. I don't have any proprietary conclusions on Snowflake, except, you know, how fast they've grown and what they've accomplished in, you know, a relatively short period of time is staggering. But I think, you know, if you know, Mr. Buffett has brought on Mr. Weschler and Mr. Combs and given them a free rein, and I think that's a very healthy thing for the organization on a go-forward basis.
Okay. We have another question about Buffett's China investments. How are they doing, and what do we know about his views of China? Do you have any insights into that?
I think they've historically had an investment in BYD. I don't know that they've got, and I don't have the number in front of me about what that is currently, and I don't know that there's been an enormous amount of additional investment in China. The investment in the five or six Japanese trading houses was, you know, was kind of interesting, and I think it besides potentially being cheap stocks that have plenty of upside and not much downside, I think it does hopefully open a door for Berkshire to be in the flow of potential wholly owned transactions that might come their way in Japan. So, but China, I don't have any other additional comments.
Andrew, did you have any thoughts there?
No, I mean, I've just second Larry. I mean, I think the Japanese investments are interesting. It's about a $6 billion investment total, which is meaningful for Berkshire, and I think those are undervalued companies, and I think he saw an opportunity there.
Do you think he was sending a signal about the Japanese market as well?
I think so. I think it may be a signal that he thinks it's undervalued. It's dramatically underperformed the U.S. market, so I think
Okay. Another question, and Larry, maybe you can explain this to listeners. What are the characteristics and relative attractions of Berkshire A versus Berkshire B shares?
The historically you've got greater voting with the A shares, and you know the economic divisor is like you know, divide by 1,500 and you'll get the equivalent economic value of the B shares. So That's been, don't forget, the Bs were originally created when somebody many years ago, a brokerage firm was going to do an offering tracking Berkshire, and they decided they didn't want that, so they created the B shares. And since that divisor has changed, and sometimes, you know, they often trade very close together, sometimes they don't. And again, there's different amounts of liquidity, but it, you know, for from my perspective, I don't think if one feels, I don't think I look at them very differently. Although if the price, you know, the difference between the B's and the A's was ever, you know, very out of whack, you'd certainly want to, you know, if you were actively buying, you know, buy one and not the other, and even create some kind of an arbitrage, one versus the other.
All right, two more questions we've got. One has to do with the Apple position. Do you think it's too big?
I mean, who gets to tackle this one, Larry or Andrew?
Who wants to? Andrew, you started. Do you have a
Andrew,
thought
go
there?
Ahead.
No, I mean, I think it's about $100 billion, and I think it's basically, it was originally about a $35 or $40 billion position when he bought it. It had an enormous appreciation. I think the stock has maybe gotten maybe a little bit ahead of itself, but I think given the size of Berkshire Hathaway, I think it's reasonably sized right now. It's big. It's by far the biggest position in his equity portfolio. It's probably 40-plus percent of it, but given the quality of the company, I think it's fine.
All right, and then we have a question about airline stocks. It's more about airlines than Berkshire, but I'll throw it out anyway. It seems unusual for Warren Buffett to dump cyclical airline stocks at their lows. Why not hold them for a comeback? Or do you think this points to a bigger structural problem in the airline industry? Larry, do you have any insights or thoughts there?
No, I mean, you would have to ask him. I think his public comments at the annual meeting, you know, seemed to imply he felt, you know, the industry was impaired and he decided to change his mind. Don't forget, Berkshire also has a very material, wholly owned business called Precision Cast Parts, which provides parts and other services to the aerospace industry. And so there is a overlapping material exposure. But, you know, he decided that something had changed and it was a permanent, at least for a while, change, and decided to change gears. And by the way, I think that's another healthy thing to see in any organization that you're trying to judge capital allocation by, to change your mind occasionally when the facts change.
I think that's an excellent observation. I have one final question for both of you. What have you learned about investing from studying Warren Buffett through so many years? Andrew, we'll start with you.
I mean, I would think investing in companies that are familiar, that are relatively simple, and basically sticking with them and basically not selling them too soon. So I think he's wrote out a number of big investments over many years, and I think it's really benefited Berkshire.
How about you, Larry? What have you learned from studying Buffett?
Well, you know, I can still remember reading, you know, a section of the 87 annual report where Mr. Buffett said, you know, Charlie and I let our marketable securities tell us by their operating results, not by their daily or even yearly price quotations, whether the investments are successful. And trying to remind everybody how important it is to distinguish between price and value, and how stocks are pieces of businesses, and you want to buy with a margin of safety. These are all critical concepts. Everybody, you know, interprets them or translates them into action in somewhat different ways. But I think, you know, when you're a young person, and it's either kind of a light bulb moment for you and how to think about things in a logical way, or it's not.
Well, I'm impressed that you can quote from the 1987 annual report.
These are the things,
so I'm
these are the
end
things
the
I remember. I have other things I forget, but these are the things I remember.
Right, probably what you had for breakfast. But I'm going to end the call by saying happy birthday, Warren Buffett, and thank you, Larry Pitkowski and Andrew Barry, for a fascinating conversation today. And thank you to our listeners for the great questions and for your time. Please join me again tomorrow when I'll be speaking with Deputy Editor Alex Yule on the outlook for tech companies and their stocks. We'll be discussing what the launch of the iPhone 12 means for Apple, how Amazon Prime Day is going, and which tech companies are likely to post the best gains in third quarter earnings. So until then, stay healthy, stay well, and thanks for your time. Bye-bye.
Thank you.